these stocks up 50, 100, 200% very, very quickly because the size of the sector is so small relative to the other indices that any fund flows into the sector will drive a big impact. And we have not seen any fund flows into the gold sector from an institutional investor perspective, probably since March 2021 and the pre-COVID period. So that's why I'm so positive. The fundamentals are fantastic. The valuations are very, very low. I think the stage is set for the gold sector.
Michael Gentile, good morning to you. How are you?
Hey, Andy, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming on board here. I got some questions for you, and I'm quite the fan here. For the last couple of years, one of the things that I'm very interested in your opinion is, what is the 2025 market look like in your mind for gold stocks? And I'm of the opinion that this is the year, but I want your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing commodity investing, Andy, for over 25 years, and I've said publicly, well, last year, I've never seen a market where I've been so right on a commodity call and not got paid for my stocks yet. But I think that yet is the key word in that sentence there. So as you know, gold made new all-time highs late last year. I've been bullish on these gold stocks since, you know, gold was $1,300 in 2018. And typically, when you see a commodity making new all-time highs, like you've seen your career, Andy, you have a lot of excitement, a lot of interest, equity interest, retail interest, institutional interest. We have not seen that in the precious metal space. It's a highly unusual situation where the companies are starting to cash flow tremendous amounts of profit margins of the free cash flow here. The large mid-cap producers are starting to make a heck of a lot of money. Yet there's very little interest in buying those stocks and even less interest in buying the small mid-cap, micro-cap stocks that I'm heavily involved in as well. So yeah, the yet in that sentence is key. What's been happening, Andy, is, you know, the market's been really, really strong the last couple of years. The Magnificent Seven, the tech stocks, the NASDAQ has really been a place where investors can basically close their eyes, buy seven stocks, and make a ton of money. It reminds me of the late 1990s during the dot-com boom. You know, you bought the dot-coms, you bought the big tech stocks, and you could just make money hand over fist. So if you're making money so easily in the biggest, most liquid stocks in America, there's not a lot of interest for investors to rotate down to other sectors. I'm very hopeful. I'm very confident that, like you said, 2025 is going to be the year for a few reasons. One, the fundamentals have dramatically improved for the industry. So the company's margins are actually going up. They're actually earning a lot of free cash flow. Their profitability is going up. Sector-wise, the gold sector probably has the best year-over-year comparisons in terms of earnings and cash flow and outlook for any sector in the market. So that's going to start to attract the average generalist attention in 2025. And, you know, we're only, what, 10-15 days into the new year so far, but so far this year, the market's kind of stumbled out of the gate. So the S&P is down this year, the NASDAQ's down this year. I checked on Friday, the GDXJ is up 6%. So when you start to see the gold stocks outperforming the indices, and if even to see if tech or the NASDAQ or the S&P 500 just goes sideways, flat to down in 2025, and gold stocks continue to go up, you're going to start to see rotation of capital to the industry. And the gold sector is so small, and a small percentage of people selling 1% of their tech stock portfolio and moving into gold could have these stocks up 50, 100, 200% very, very quickly because the size of the sector is so small relative to the other indices that any fund flows into the sector will drive a big impact. And we have not seen any fund flows into the gold sector from an institutional investor perspective, probably since March 2021 and the pre-COVID period. So that's why I'm so positive. The fundamentals are fantastic. The valuations are very, very low. I think the stage is set for the gold sector to outperform on a stock market return basis the rest of the market, and that'll attract more fund flows and attract more eyeballs on our space. And these stocks would all be primed to have some significant rallies in the back of that.
So that's a really good answer. And there's two things that, I guess two different situations in the past 25 years, and I've been doing this a long time. The first one was 2000, as you mentioned, when the tech boom, the NASDAQ started really correcting there. I was in the market. That's a long story. But what was interesting to me is how gold, and correct me if I'm wrong, the gold and gold stocks really significantly outperformed, in fact, did very, very well during that time. The opposite of that is 2007, 2008, when we had the credit markets completely contract, if not just really just seize up. What would it be? I mean, obviously your take is of the latter. But how could you see, again, another correction like we had in 2007, 2008? Because that's really my fear here, if you would, at this moment, even though I don't think it's going to happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say yes. There's two scenarios. I think your viewers have to remember that when the stock market crashes, and we're talking about a crash, I'm not talking about a down 5%. Investors have got a bit too greedy and too complacent. They think, oh, market's down 5% after the crash. No, a crash is like you saw the dot-com boom busted in 2001. The NASDAQ was down 80 to 90% from its peak. You know, in 2007, 2008, when the market rolled over in March of 08, the S&P was down like 50%, 50 from its peak. So in a crash where the stock market is in total free fall or plummeting, gold stocks are gold producers, but they're also stocks. So when every stock in the market is going down 50%, you will have some pain in your portfolio. So I'm not here to say if the market crashes 50% tomorrow, if you own a boatload of gold stocks, you're going to be laughing as that happens. The stocks will go down. But in all those cases, Andy, when the big crashes happened in the dot-com boom or in 08, if you look, the first stocks to rally out of the crash and the best performing stocks out of the crash were the gold stocks. And why is that the case? Is because typically the response of the government to a major crash is to print even more money. You know, what's unique about this cycle, Andy, is we're printing boatloads of money. We haven't even had a recession or a crash yet. So imagine how much money we're going to have to print if we end up, taking on water and drowning here as a market. So yeah, so you will have, if this market crashes, your stocks will go down like every other stock goes down, but they're probably the best performing stocks on the way out, which is why I'm comfortable holding them into kind of any market environment. The first scenario I talked about was a scenario where the market just sort of rolls over, like, you know, NASDAQ's up 25-30%, pretty solid last kind of 3, 4, 5 years. If that starts to stop, even if NASDAQ's flat to down 5% for the next couple of years, investors will get bored. They'll no longer be making easy money in the market. They'll say, where can I make some money? And that's where I highlight a big land on the gold sector being probably the best fundamentally driven sector in terms of fundamental cash flow earnings and growth, but also in terms of valuation. So in a scenario where the market's just sort of being stagnant or rolling over slowly, I think the gold stocks will be outperforming and attract a lot of capital. In a crash scenario, I think you want to be buying those stocks even more in a crash because you know they're going to be the first ones out of the gate to rally even harder. And that money printing will be adding even more fuel to the fire that's already started in the gold space in terms of a positive backdrop.
Yeah, great answer. Yeah, great answer. So let me ask you this is what's going to happen in your mind? You said what's going to happen first? Is it going to be institutional money coming into the sector? Is the retail investor going to have to come into this sector? Because you brought up a great point. You haven't seen institutions really come into this sector since 21. Are they starting to come into now? I guess that's a two-part question.
Yeah, we're starting to see it. We're starting to see the bigger names do better. So last year, single asset producers, like Lundin Gold, the Canadian Mining, they had good years. The mid to larger caps like Alamos are having good years as well. So we're starting to see some institutional money come into the space, but it's very cautious money. Andy, it's names that are generating a lot of cash flow with clean balance sheets, but there is some there. They've yet to move down cap. When the investors typically move down cap, what institutions do is they start lagging the indices. So most institutions, if you did a pool of 100 institutions, I bet my kids on them, they're dramatically underweight gold. Most institutions are underweight gold. And so it doesn't hurt them if the NASDAQ's up 30 and the gold sector's up 25. You go, okay, well, I'm not underperforming the market. But let's say like this year, GDXJ is up 6, the market's down 3. Those long-only institutional investors don't own gold as part of the index in Canada in a bigger way, and less so in the U.S., start to underperform their indices due to the fact that they don't own gold, and therefore they're under pressure to allocate more money to the sector to catch up that fall behind performance that they're having. Well, then they'll typically go down cap because down cap, they know they can make bigger returns and catch up faster. So we're starting to see the first wave of just allocation, but when it starts to hurt their performance, you'll see a more of a rush to allocate and you'll see the moving down cap to catch up on performance wise. And then retail is the same thing. I mean, if you can make 50% in a day buying Fartcoin, or these other meme coins you're buying in the crypto space, that speculative retail money is less inclined to go seek out other speculative opportunities. So the speculative money has really been caught up in the whole AI and crypto kind of mania space that you have right now. If that rolls over, then that speculative money will want to find a new home. And one of the best places to be, or the best place to be, in my opinion, would be the gold sector. So it's hard to say who's going to come first, whether it be retail or institutional, but that's the path that you see. So I'm seeing early innings of institutional allocation. I'm not seeing the retail interest there yet, despite the record high prices of gold. But as a contrarian investor, I actually like that a lot. That tells me there's a lot of return to come my way. When I see every retail investor I know buying gold stocks, every institution I know buying gold stocks, I probably know we got 3 to 9 months left in the rally. Whereas here, I do see the stage set for a multi-year rally because there's so little participation. There's a lot of buyers yet to come versus that are already on the boat, versus other sectors where the boats are full. There's not many incremental buyers left to drive these, tech stocks or cryptos higher going forward.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So next question is, if I'm a retail investor here, so how do we start with, because that's one of the biggest questions I get from a lot of people that I talk to is, hey, Andy, I want to buy gold and I want to buy gold stocks, but I don't know what to do. And my advice, again, this is not advice here, but what I would do is I would start with the bigger names, the big producers, if you would, and then work downstream. Would you say that's a good strategy, or what would you do in that regard?
Yeah, for sure. I would say you could start, if you want to be really passive, you could start with the indices. So GDX is the kind of senior producer index. You'll get your Barricks, your Newmonts, the other bigger companies that'll be in there. If you want to get a little bit more torque, you can go to GDXJ, which is another passive ETF index of smaller mid-tier producers, often with little one or two mines. I would say do your homework, you know. So this is, investing is risky to begin with. You know, gold stocks or smaller capitalization companies are inherently even more risky than that. So I would say don't go willy-nilly and buy the first stock you hear on a YouTube interview, but go do your homework. If you believe in the thesis and you believe that gold can outperform, you could buy it passively through those two indices and get good exposure to, you know, the average performance of the sector that way. And then if you want to buy single names, you can buy producing assets that have varying cash flow, that have leverage to the rising gold price immediately in terms of their profitability, kind of quarter to quarter. As the gold price goes up, they make more and more money and more profits. And then you can go to the Wild West, which I spend a lot of my time investing, which is the exploration sector, which is, you know, high risk, high reward, right? So there's names that could be up 10, 20, 30 times your money, but it can also be down, you know, 80%. But in a rising market, what we're starting with valuations where they are, the potential to make, you know, exponential returns in the more kind of riskier early stage side of the market is very, very high. But kind of to use a skiing analogy, it's kind of a black diamond. It's kind of experts only or people that want to spend the time to research these companies and understand that you can't just buy one. You're probably going to buy, you know, 10 or 20, kind of spread your bets. And you're looking for 20, 30 times your money if you're right, but you're willing to stomach down 50 or down 60 or down 70% if you're wrong. But in general, I would say a rising tide lifts all boats. And I feel this sector is extremely cheap, extremely unloved, underfollowed, underappreciated. So I forecast multiple years of really good performance coming out of the gold sector in general. And then depending on your risk tolerance, you can choose whether you're shooting for 20 to 30, 40% returns or 100% plus returns, understanding that each time you reach for a return, you're taking on a little bit more risk. But if you're right about the sector, everyone should do well and understand what your risk tolerance is and how you want to attack that call. It's really a personal financial decision that you should make with your advisor.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you said. Speaking of that, though, when you are going into the explorations, and I spent a lot of time there, both explorers going to producers with the high potential of getting taken out or just people that are just starting, I have my own criteria when I'm evaluating these companies. What's just maybe two or three things that you really look for when you're evaluating a company to add to your portfolio?
That's a good question. I mean, I've been investing institutionally, Andy, in producers, in more larger kind of senior oriented companies for 25 plus years. And then 6 years ago, I took a little time off work, getting daughters and a bunch of like home. I was really at home investing my own money. And that's when I really got into the earlier stage exploration companies. So I kind of took a unique approach to investing in early stage exploration, which is inherently very risky. I tried to reverse engineer when I started. Okay, I'm investing in producers for 25 years. What are the hallmarks that make a producing mine? And then try to reverse engineer, back engineer that onto an exploration story. So it doesn't have all the attributes that could allow this operation to become a mine one day. Because I'm a little different. I mean, when I'm making investments in juniors, I have a kind of a 3 to 10 year horizon. I'm taking personally 5 to 20% ownership stakes in these companies. So I'm not buying a stock on Monday, hoping to sell it on Friday. I'm buying a stock in 2025. Knowing I'm probably selling it in 2032, like 7 years from now.
Right.
It's the only way that I make money on these early stage investments that I'm making is if the company progresses and becomes a mine. And if it becomes a mine and I'm buying it at $10 million or $20 million market cap, the eventual takeout when it's a mine one day could be $500 million to $1 billion if everything goes right. So what I'm looking for is what are the hallmarks or attributes that give that story that I'm buying a very early stage of its life a chance to be a mine. And there's a lot of things that I look at, but, you know, grade. So that's your margin. It's got enough grade to be profitable per ounce when you produce it or whatever quantity you're producing. Scale. Does it have enough size to justify the investment, the mills, the roads, the power that has to go in to build a mine? Jurisdiction. You know, is it in a place where you're allowed some money? Do you have the social license or the government license? Is mining banned there, or is the local community, I guess, that they're going to boycott your mine even if you have success, right? Management, you know, does management have the attributes, what it takes to raise the money and de-risk the project over time. And every company has a different stage of development, and you need different management for different stages of that. You know, the financial side of things, they have this financial understanding of when to raise money or how to raise money or who to raise money from. So a lot of characters that go into the story that will determine that their cap structure, who owns the stock, you know, how much cheap paper is out there, a lot of warrants out there, you know, where it's you know, very hard for the stock to trade up because everybody owns cheap paper that they're constantly selling in the market. So a lot of different nuances that I go through it, but looking for those hallmarks of a potential mine, buying it really cheaply, getting the right cycle and de-risking the project over time, that's how you can make, you know, 20, 30, 50 times your money. Understanding that even if it has all the right hallmarks, a lot of stuff can go wrong along the way. And so my investment approach, almost like a private equity or a venture capital fund, you know, I buy 30 companies. I know upfront that probably 20 out of the 30 are not going to become mines, they're not going to work out. And if I have 2, 3, or 4 that go all the way from discovery to a producing status, those companies will make me so much money that my overall return is going to be fantastic, even though I'm wrong more often than I'm right. It's a different approach. It's a venture capital approach. It's not a, you know, buy Microsoft or Walmart or blue chip portfolio trying to make 8% a year. It's a different dynamic, looking for higher returns, but systematically investing and willing to stomach the volatility that you'll have inherently in a portfolio like that.
Yeah. Sounds like a Warren Buffett approach almost. Let me ask you this is, how much does jurisdiction play in you? I know that you just mentioned that. Do you go to places that are a lot more risky, if you would, and just coming to mind parts of Central America? Like, for example, there's a lot of stuff going on in Mexico right now with permitting. Yep. Or are you parts of Africa because they're unstable? Or do you just really try to maybe North America or maybe some parts of Europe just really stable or just first?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've had this question many times on jurisdiction. I find that discussion on jurisdiction is way too black or white. So it's like Canada, Australia, US, good. West Africa, Latin America, bad. You can dig under the carpet there and see what you're looking at. Canada, yes, you have great security of ownership. You have pretty stable taxation laws, you know, good political jurisdiction in terms of losing the mine, title to the mine. But it takes you 15 to 20 years to permit a mine in Canada. So you're trading off stability of kind of taxation and title for timeline to production. Whereas in West Africa and some of these other countries, more emerging countries, you can go from discovery to production in 3 or 4 years. So yeah. When you get a discounted cash flow model, I've got to wait 15 years for capital versus getting in at 4 years. Inherently, the 4-year one is going to be more valuable. But in those countries where it's much quicker to go into production, there is more risk on taxation law changing, governments changing, social license changing. So really for me, it's jurisdiction is a case-by-case basis. And even within Canada, there's certain parts of Quebec, Ontario, and BC that I love to invest in, and other parts that I would not invest that are more difficult to operate in. So you've really got to look at the micro level and really understand, okay, back to my point, does it have all the geological hallmarks to become a mine? Yes. Does it have the social license? The social license has become very micro. Even parts of Africa, different countries or different jurisdictions within a country of Africa can change dramatically in terms of positively or negatively. So you have to understand, where are the risks? What are likely to be coming in mind? What's the support I have to build this thing? And then price it appropriately. If you've got a 12-year horizon in Canada, that's fine. But you got to discount that properly to pay the right price 12 years away to have that return when you're in production 12 years later. So I don't like making broad statements. I'm invested in West Africa. I'm invested in Latin America. I'm invested in Canada. I'm invested in the U.S. And there's also parts of those countries that I wouldn't touch as well, depending on the work that I do and understanding of that local geography or market ahead of my investment.
Yeah, great answer. So I always thought about, I will take on the risk to a jurisdiction, I guess, that is not, air quotes, stable, as long as I'm justly compensated, if you would. And I know that the benefit is more than likely we're going to get permitted in a much, much quicker time frame. So we'll be cash flowing that much sooner. So the return on my investment will become back much sooner. Let's go, all of our listeners are going to want to know this. If you could give us a couple of names of companies either that you're invested in or that you are just looking at or thinking about going into. And
sure. And again, my advice would be to understand the risks you're taking when you look at these investments. And I own a portfolio of 20 to 30 names, depending on your risk tolerance and what kind of return, what kind of risk you're willing to take. But I'm happy to highlight a few names that I think have been kind of more de-risked in a way, and that are on a pathway either to become a mine or have something substantial that could be a mineable ore body or a valuable asset in the future. One of them would be, Arizona Metals, AMC. Stock hit a high in the last month for gold around $7 a share. Canadian is trading at $1.50 Canadian today. It's in Arizona. One of the highest grade, ore bodies I've seen in a long time in Arizona, kind of 3% plus copper, heavily gold, underrated, relatively shallow, great jurisdiction, roads, power, infrastructure, and a very mining friendly state of Arizona. Company recently financed themselves for $27 million. They got over $30 million cash in the banks. They're well funded. They just brought in a management team that's built multiple mines in their past career. The chairman, the CEO, are very experienced. Stock has been under pressure, tax loss selling, a bunch of, negative feedback and just negative retail angst on the stock. But I think 2025 is going to be a very exciting year for them. Lots of catalysts, their first resource coming out, first PEA coming out, brand new discovery at K2, drilling gold property called Sugarloaf. So lots and lots of news flow, no need for financing. And the stock is down, 70% plus off the highs. I think that's a good name to kick the tires on for 2025, especially in the backdrop we talked about. North Superior Resources is in Quebec, another really good jurisdiction. 4 million ounces in Quebec, trading at my valuation around $10 to $15 Canadian per ounce in the ground. They're right next door to Nelligan, which is a 5 million ounce deposit owned by IAM Gold. So between the two companies, there's 10 million ounces. They're close to 10 million ounces of gold and resources in the ground already. The big mining companies, Andy, they're looking for assets that can produce 300,000 to 500,000 ounces a year. So when you start talking about 10 or 15 million ounces of resource, that starts to get the attention of the major mining companies, and North Superior is in a really good position. That stock too has sort of been going sideways for 18 months. We talked about earlier, not a lot of interest in the sector. They just spun out a company called OnGold Ontario Assets. It's probably worth about $40 million today of shares they own on the balance sheet. North Superior owns of that company. So a lot of hidden value there too. So that's another one I would encourage investors to take a look at. And North Isle Copper and Gold is another interesting one in BC, another good jurisdiction. Used to be a big kind of 30-year, $1.5 billion copper porphyry project, which is a little hard for investors to stomach because the markets are not very supportive right now in terms of valuation. The company made a major gold discovery called Northwest Expo last year, basically found 1 million ounces of gold at 1 gram right at surface, right next to their large copper porphyry. Total game changer. That's your first 5-10 years in mining. Very profitable, very high grade. Will pay the bills for the larger 30-year mine behind it. So it's almost to get a free, starter pit, we call it, or a starter operation. They're putting a new PEA in Q1. The old PEA only had the copper porphyry. The new PEA is going to include the major new gold discoveries they've made. I think it's going to be dramatically positive for the economics of that project. I went to site there myself. Again, incredible infrastructure, power, roads, hydro, wind farm already on site. Great savings, great case to build a mine. So those are three kind of buildable, high quality assets, kind of trading a deep discounted valuation here. Obviously lots of others that I like, but I'll probably stop there to the benefit of time.
Michael, thank you so much. If people want to do business with you and if they want to follow you, how do they do that?
Yeah, so when I talk about my juniors, it's all my own money. I don't have a fund. I don't solicit investors. I'm involved in a firm called Bastion Asset Management. I'm sure it's a different business and involved in institutional equity. So not the juniors I was talking about earlier. Best way to follow me is look me up on YouTube. I'll do interviews like this, once every 2, 3, 4 weeks, just to share my views with investors. Very, very passionate. I probably have, vast majority of my money invested in the metals and mining space. And I think it's going to be a great year, 2025. It's a good time for investors to start educating themselves. Thanks, guys like yourself. Give investors a bit of a head start on that. It was supposed to be a very exciting year this year in 2025. But yeah, YouTube's the best way to find me and try to give my views publicly so everybody can hear what I'm saying at the same time.
All right. I will link to that. And just so all of our viewers know that Michael's very, very responsive. And so I'm very grateful of that. Michael, thank you so much for all of your insights. And I would love to have you on again here in the next quarter or so.
My pleasure. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.